Orson Welles,
Buster Keaton,
Agnes Barda,
Alain Resnais,
John Hughes,
Steven Spielberg, Robert Altman. Jumpstart Cinema,
presented by New Filmmakers LA.
Hi, I'm Paloma Bennett, cinema scholar and co-host of Jumpstart Cinema.
I'm Varda Barkar, filmmaker and board co-chair of New Filmmakers Los Angeles.
Today, as our filmmaker guests, we have with us Sherry Gawk, director of Glorious Call, the short film from the upcoming New Filmmakers Los Angeles screening event we think you must see. Sherry, thank you for coming on our podcast.
Thank you.
Where were you born? How did you get into directing?
Sure. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. And how did I get into directing? I'm 65 years old, let's start with that. And in the early 70s, I was exposed to very early video art. I was in school at Minneapolis College of Art and Design and was exposed to a lot of the early video artists, like and filmmakers Michael Snow and Peter Campos, and you know, these a lot of artists from New York would come to my school. And those were the days of Sony Portapak. So I started, some of my earliest pieces are from 1976, and they're Sony Portapak.
What is Sony Portapak? Can you describe that?
Yeah, it was the very first portable video equipment. So prior to that, artists didn't really have access to video equipment. They had, you know, there was video equipment in TV studios. And the Sony Portapak was invented so that, and what was great about it is artists used it and activists used it. So it was all of a sudden like demonstrations could be recorded or you could go to a country and record some kind of, you know, a political abuse, or an artist could use it in creative ways. So the artist William Wegman, whose work is collected in museums, he started doing work with the Sony Portapak. So it was a reel-to-reel machine, and it had the camera was separate and a big fat cable that connected the two. So, and I really liked it. I was excited because it was literally a brand new medium in a way. I was a young art student. And so I did some early pieces that were kind of experimental. Some were installations, some were live installations where they were interactive and people could, you know, interact with them in a space, but then in 74, I went to Scotland in a program, and I actually was working with Sally Potter, who's the filmmaker now, very well-known filmmaker, and I was exposed to performance art. So for many years, I actually focused more in performance art than in filmmaking or video art making. And I was very excited by that because it was really a new art form. And as a woman wanting to make art about being a woman, you know, to be able to pick up a medium that had no domination by male artists, it was like drawing and painting and sculpture that had these traditions. It was this all new art form that really felt comfortable to me as a woman. So I guess what I'm saying is my career has taken a lot of different forms. I consider myself a visual artist who makes films. And I did performance art, I've done public art, I've done artist books, and now kind of late in life, I'm returning to filmmaking as my primary medium.
Oh, is your primary medium?
Yeah, pretty much now these days, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
I mean, I'm also developing a public art proposal right now that I was invited to do. But I mean, it's interesting now, in my life, I literally just retired from teaching full time. So I've been teaching high school students video for 31 years, and it's been amazing.
Wow.
And I've just retired to do my own work full time. And so what I decided to do is my first feature length documentary. I've never done anything feature length, and I was never even really that interested in it. But it hit me one day that I wanted to tell the story of women in performance art.
Oh, wow, that would be nice.
And how radical that was as an art form in the 70s. So I have a film that I'm working on called Acting Like Women, Performance Art and the Woman's Building. So the Woman's Building was this organization that I moved to Los Angeles in 1975 from the Midwest to be involved in. And it was this sort of hotbed of all these women artists coming together and reinventing what art could be in relationship to an audience, in relationship to society and culture, and how it could be a tool for activism or a tool for self-expression, that could be transformative. So that's the feature documentary I'm in the very early stages of developing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I took one art class, history class in college, and it was about modern art, and we did study performance art. One activist was a woman who was cleaning steps of a museum.
Mm-hmm.
Of art. I'm forgetting her name right now.
Merle Laterman Ukelis, I believe is how you say her name. She's a New York artist. There was also a group in Los Angeles called Mother Art who did a similar thing. They cleaned up the banks and they cleaned up and they went to public places and scrubbed. And so one of the things I'm interested in, the feature that I'm working on, is how the West Coast artists and the West Coast movement has not been very well written into the history. So when you study something like that, you probably study the New York artists.
Yeah, and then the European as well.
Yes, and then meanwhile on the West Coast, there was an incredibly innovative bunch of stuff happening. So that's the story that I plan to tell.
Well, I think, you know, based on your short film, Gloria's Call, if it's anything like that, it has that approach, it's going to be quite extraordinary and illuminating and eye-opening. You're opening eyes, for sure.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you to talk about your film, Gloria's Call, and how you kind of met the art history professor and academic.
Yes. Gloria Ornstein is her name. And she's a very interesting person. She started these what was called the Feminist Salon. They were literary salons in New York in the 70s. And all the luminaries of feminist writing like Kate Millett and various people came through that salon. And she moved to Los Angeles to teach at USC, University of Southern California, in the, I think, late 70s. So she was kind of part of, she was a woman I knew about, a scholar. She started out as a literary and theater scholar, but her life was transformed. And this is the story that our film tells, is in 1970 when she met Leonora Carrington, the surrealist artist who was English but living in Mexico. And she kind of got drawn into this world of these women surrealist artists and meeting them and having her life changed and just seeing how kind of wild and amazing their work could be and how wild and amazing her life could be as a result. You know, she was kind of going for a fairly traditional academic thing before that. So I knew Gloria, my friends and I knew Gloria because she was sort of in our community. She was a feminist scholar in our community. She wrote a book called The Reflowering of the Goddess, which was about artists who had goddess imagery in their artwork. So she's written about my art as, you know, my art in her book. And then in the 80s, she organized this first national conference, or first international conference on ecofeminism at USC. And she invited me and the late Rachel Rosenthal to co-curate a performance art evening. So we did that. So she's somebody that I've known for a while. And how the film came to be is there's an organization called the Southern California Women's Caucus for Art. And I'm a member, and they were having this surrealist tea, and we were told to wear fanciful hats and come to this place in Pasadena where we were having tea. Gloria was like the entertainment. She was going to be doing a little talk. Well, here we were in this tea room. She didn't have a microphone. There were other customers there. It was very noisy. And she gets up and she starts telling these fantastical stories about Leonora Carrington and Leonore Fini and you know, Merritt Oppenheim. And we were just like, oh my gosh. And I turned to the women around me, my friends, and I said, we should make a film of this. This is amazing. Let's put her in a studio. Let's light her beautifully. Let's mic her and have her tell these stories. And then we will animate them. Now, I had never done animation before. None of us had ever done animation before.
Wow. So it was an amazing job.
You did.
I did, yeah. But one of the things I do in my work with teens is I co-created a program called the Righteous Conversations Project. And what we do with that, we started it in 2011, is we bring Holocaust survivors and teens together. So we recognize that we're in this kind of amazing moment of history when we won't have the survivors of the Holocaust around for much longer. They're in their 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And we needed teenagers to be able to spend time hearing these people's, you know, first person histories. So in fact, that's what I've been doing all day today, is working with my teens and survivors. So we bring them together and the survivors tell their stories and then the teens animate them under the supervision of these amazing animation teachers. So I've been kind of executive producing. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Years and watching teenagers do it. I'm like, oh, how hard could it be, you know, doing this animation? Of course, it was very challenging. I mean, we, you know, like I said, we'd never done it. So we had to learn drag and frame stop motion. We had to learn After Effects. And mostly we had to just wrap our brains around how do you animate? You know, it's a very unique art form. Mm-hmm. And we hired a young CalArts student to basically advise us, you know, like help us do this, you know, help, you know, show us the way kind of thing. And the thing I mostly remember is that she just kept saying, you need to be wilder. You need to like scribble more and cut things up. And, you know, and so that was very fun. It was just very liberating to kind of push through and keep making the work more and more expressive.
I think I really felt that. And actually, I wanted to make a comment about, you just talked about your program. I went to Santa Monica High School and we hosted a yearly annual film festival. And actually, I just went back. And one of your films from one of your students was in the film festival. Wow! So
yeah,
I just saw it.
Yeah, every year we have films in your festival, yeah. Absolutely.
So I just saw it, and I was like, whoa, I remember that.
Is that from the Holocaust?
Yeah, I recognize that name, because I recognize I saw the film.
That's incredible. Yeah. What a small world.
And I have to tell you, as an aside, I actually, just a few weeks ago, I was at the Cannes Film Festival. And we were at a youth film festival here in L.A., and the woman who runs the American Pavilion, Julie Sisk, saw one of our Holocaust films, and she was like, I love this film. I want to invite you to show in the Emerging Filmmaker Showcase at the American Pavilion at the Cannes Film Festival. We're like, cool, okay. So a student and I, a 12-year-old boy and his family, and I went over there, and we won Best Student Documentary.
That's crazy.
Oh, my
gosh.
That's
amazing.
Wow, congratulations.
We were college students. We were, you know, in a program with college students, and we won with our high school film. So, yeah, it was cool. I've been an educator for all these years, and teaching is very important to me. And teaching is not just about learning things. It's about kind of having your life transformed and changed. And so I think that spirit is in everything that I do, whether I'm teaching a class or facilitating students, I'm also doing that. So Glory's Call is a good example where, you know, it's not just making this fun film, it's really looking at what don't we know? You know, we don't know about a lot of these women artists. We don't know the important role women played within the movement of surrealism and how they were sort of given short shrift by the male artists. We don't know about kind of the world. We kind of live in this world, but then there's a sort of world underneath it that Gloria is very open to, this kind of, you know, metaphysical, spiritual, mysterious world. And so the film Gloria's Call is about her getting this call from Leonora Carrington that took her into this world. But then, as she says in the film, and I finally thought that I'd gotten this call, and it was really great. I didn't expect to get another call. And in the 80s, when she is organizing this conference on ecofeminism, this shaman from Samiland shows up at USC and says, I've come, the great spirit has called you. And so she goes on yet another journey in her life where she, you know, really opens herself up to this kind of, these spirits in a way. And so I think, you know, there's so many things we don't know. And it's fun when art can open up new worlds for all of us.
Yeah, there were some really powerful moments in the film for me. One of them was the woman child, when the husband called. I kind of echoed back to connecting the theater act, the doll's house. And the fact that, I'm thinking the character's name, but she was treated like a doll, like a child, like a woman child. And that really kind of echoed back to me, the feeling of being put in this box and being pushed in and being forced into this role. And also the other one, it was a beautiful painting that really depicted the woman's actual, the artist's feeling. I think this was, I wrote the name down, the artist. It was Jane Groverell. And that she was that she was trapped by her, by unable to talk. It was her husband refusing to have her engaged. That she was like the lion in the cage, the tiger in the cage,
oh,
as
yeah.
he painted. And that was really, that was amazing. Just having, just the painting, just the tiger, just the painting itself was so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
In that
moment.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yes, and I love in that scene when, you know, and Gloria's trying to hear, she's trying to communicate to Gloria, and Gloria's trying to understand what she's saying. The husband's saying, don't pay any attention to her. She doesn't know what she's saying. And when I edited that, I put this in the sound design, I put this growling tiger underneath to kind of represent her rage at not being able to have a voice.
Yes. Also, this reminds me of Zelda Fitzgerald. I mean, just there's so many female artists who it must have been so painful and so torturous. I mean, it's still happening. But, you know, to know, like, that you've got this expression and it's being suppressed. Like, you can't be you. You know, you can't be fully expressed.
Mm-hmm.
You captured. What I really loved about your film was that it embodied what it was about. That I felt like it was, you know, just 100% expressive of what it was talking about, you know, just like it was just kind of all became this one expression, you know. And I also love what you were talking about, which is like this discovery or kind of this eye-opening, this realization, you know. And I found it personally empowering, you know, as a filmmaker myself and as an artist, you know, to that it was dealing with themes and visions and that you know, preoccupying me and like occupying me, that I don't really often talk about just because I don't want people to think I'm crazy, basically.
Exactly. I mean, that's a way that women have been silenced throughout history, is that when we do say what we know or see or think, that we've been called crazy. So, and you know, honestly, when we were putting the film together, that was a concern we had. We didn't want people to think, oh, this woman with this flaming red hair who's telling these wild stories is crazy. You know, we wanted to really ground it that Gloria is a scholar.
Yeah.
She's a very deep thinker, and she's very educated. And, you know, so it was something that we thought about a lot in the editing of the film. And that's why, you know, like a decision we made is to always refer to her as Dr. Gloria Ornstein, to establish that this is a woman of letters.
Yeah, and I think that's also really important. In grad school, I had a professor who was like, I always like to be called doctor or professor, because a lot of women are taken away from them, even though they are professors. They're not called that. So she was very strict about that.
Now, how was it for you in terms of the kind of non-rational kind of thinking, or, you know, some of like when she had the vision, like, you know, the non-logical.
Well, I think that has a place. I mean, I think in academia, I think that is part of it in a weird way, is our energy and what we feel about things and engaging. There is like it's really amazing because it's a hard thing to describe. Like, I took a course from this professor about extreme cinema, which is about the cinema of feeling, of your like visceral feelings, which is very hard to write about. But it's something that is very real and very important to cinema as well. But anyways, yeah.
So these kind
but,
of...
But I mean, people have... I mean, that does exist. It's a
people
reality.
Have visions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And I didn't find it strange, really, but that's... Or, yeah, too weird.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't think she was crazy, of course. I would not. I mean...
You did not think she
was
crazy.
No, I didn't have the response. But maybe my generation wouldn't have that response. I don't know. Okay, yeah. And I want to ask, what is your must-see feature film? In other words, a feature film from any country or era that you think listeners need to watch?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I wish I was saying a film by a woman, because I think that would be important. But the film that came up for me, a film that I'm very fond of, is what it's called, William Shakespeare's Romeo plus Juliet, I think is the official name of it, 1996 film by Baz Luhrmann. And I use that film a lot in teaching, and I think, you know, I think it's very personal in a way. I'm interested in adaptation. I think adaptation in and of itself is really interesting, how one artist looks at what another artist has done and then reinterprets it through a new lens. When I was young, the Franco Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet came out. And to me, it was just the dreamiest, most wonderful movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but with Olivia Hussey and Leonard, I'm blanking on the boy's name now. But, you know, I think when you're a teenager, like young love is the most romantic love ever. Like, do we ever get over, you know, that teenage love experience? And so anyway, that was a very beautiful kind of faithful to the period film. And then Baz Luhrmann came along in 96 and did this really cool thing where he had them speaking in the Shakespearean language, but then the scenes were contemporary. Yeah. And so I love the whole, I do like things that are stylized. I know some colleagues of mine, they don't like his movies because they don't like how stylized they are, but I think that's cool. I think it's very, and I love that he and his wife work together and that her, you know, and I always blank on her name, Catherine. She does all the costume and production design for his film. So, so this is terrible that I'm not saying her name, because without her, he's nothing. It's a case of the woman behind the man. You know, I'm not saying he's not incredibly talented, but they both are. And together they make these really interesting films. I think one of the most romantic scenes I've ever seen is when Romeo and Juliet meet for the first time through the aquarium. You know, they're both on opposite sides of the aquarium, and cinematically there are these really beautiful moments when one will lean in, you know, they're separated by glass and water and fish, but they'll lean in and the reflection of them is flipped. So suddenly they're side by side. It does these really cool optical things that I show that to my students all the time. There's this just beautiful visual storytelling. There's this whole moment of like, oh, who are you? You're cute. Wait, I'm curious, you know, in this like, I think I'm in love. You know, this whole, like, you can almost talk through what's happening there, but there are no words exchanged. It's all looking and reflection and transparency. And it's just beautiful. Other moments that I love in that film is when he comes to her funeral, and there's this beautiful shot of the whole screen is black with this just sliver of kind of blue in his eye peeking through. And I talk to my students about how, you know, you don't just show a scene, you can reveal a scene in different ways. Like, you can be behind a tree and come around to reveal your scene. But that's such a beautiful example of that, in the way the doors slowly open and he begins to see this scene of her funeral and realize what he's looking at. So anyway, it just has some beautiful moments for me, and I just think it's a lot of fun.
What is your dream project? I think you might have told us already.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just described it. It's the next one, Acting Like Women, Performance Art in the Woman's Building. And I really appreciate what you said about Gloria's Call, that the form of it kind of matched the content. And that's really what I want to do with this next film, is how do you make a film about performance art that it's a historic period in performance art, so many people will need to tell me their story, but how do I not make it a talking heads documentary? How do I make the film itself performative and active and challenging and just reinventing the form is what my goal is. So that's my challenge.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sherry, for taking the time to talk to us about your film, Gloria's Call.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
So will we see you at the program?
Absolutely.
Great. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Sherry, for taking the time to talk with us about your film, Gloria's Call. Our classic film for this month is Amy, directed by Asaf Kapida, which is a documentary about Amy Winehouse. Amy was released in 2015.
Paloma, why have you selected Amy as our classic must-see film?
Well, first of all, I actually was able to see it when I saw it in the theaters. It was kind of just blew me away. I think Amy's a very kind of unique documentary because it's told through a lot of found footage, I guess what we could call, like, stuff he found either from other documentaries or from home videos. And then he kind of records his audio interviews to kind of put over it. And I think it was very poignant in time, too, when he released it, because it was released... She'd only been dead for, I think, a couple of years. Not very long, really. I mean, I guess it was 4 years, but still. And I also really loved the style of the way they did. Like, she would have these really great... Sometimes it would show her singing a song, I think, either in a concert recording booth. And you would put in the lyrics, kind of drawn in or written in. and it really left you to be able to kind of really think about it, because when you hear song lyrics, you think, oh, this is a really cool song. But when you see it written down, you can think, oh, look, like, I can see what she's singing about. Especially because they would go, like, back to black. We had just seen how she just broken up with her longtime boyfriend, Blake, who was, I guess, they're kind of having an affair because he had another girlfriend. Since we've seen all this stuff, when we see the lyrics about, like, you know, you have to leave me and that kind of stuff, then you can see what it's about him and how personal and how it goes back to how she's saying about her through her depression and kind of dealt with her anxiety that way. I also think it's a really beautiful documentary about addiction and about fame and how we take very vulnerable people, because a lot of these songwriters, not all, but a lot of songwriters come from a very vulnerable space already. Like, I think, you know, Johnny Cash did not die, but he had a very tough childhood. Mm-hmm. And I think that you seem to kind of deal with that. And she was so, people were all over her so much. And her, you know, her father, the documentary kind of shows her father kind of also using her fame for his own benefit, that Maybe it would have been hard for her to get off the drugs ever, but she never really had a chance of it to begin with, because if you're already so vulnerable and you're being hounded and you're constantly having to perform, then you don't really have a choice to even stop, because that's how you function in the world. So you stop taking drugs and you stop being able to function.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I thought you made a really good choice with the film. I thought it was exceptional use of, or is an exceptional use of, stock footage and found footage and stills. And I was very inspired by the way he would layer things too. Like,
yeah,
he'd have a still image and then you'd see kind of like a walking through frame, like superimposed. And then he would slow things down. Then he also, I think, incorporated some, it was either stock footage or he shot some like aerial shots.
Oh, yeah.
Of like the world.
Right.
His world, like every time she moved to a different location, they showed different locations.
Establishing
shot, but they were aerial shots.
Oh, I got it. The funny thing is, because it was so together that I didn't even notice it was separate from her found footage. I didn't realize it was not the same thing.
No, me either, the first time I watched it.
Oh, yeah.
And this time I've been kind of analyzing it.
Yeah.
So I saw it differently. Plus, since I'm working on a documentary,
oh, yeah,
I'm really paying attention.
You're very serious about that.
Yeah, because that's one of the hardest things, I think, in a documentary that has a narrative, which this one does, is creating the bridges and the connecting points,
yeah,
and the rhythm and the pacing, you know, and have one thing connect to another, because it's not like it's scripted where you can write those.
Yeah.
You have to, like, find those.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
and you have
true.
To do them in a way that's convincing. And, you know, clearly, you know, this was brilliantly done.
Oh, yeah, well, it won an Oscar. So it was, and also it just reminded me that I thought the way they showed her kind of towards the end where they all know about her addiction problems, when they're following, when she's going from her car, I mean from her home to her car, and she's very skinny, she's obviously lost a lot of weight, and there's a lot of emotional pain, as well as probably physical pain. And she's very angry at kind of the camera, all those paparazzi are all over her taking pictures, and she's pushing them away because she's angry. I don't know if there was the editing, it was a lot of the editing was part of this, or if this was probably, you know, this part of what was going on, but there was a lot of flashing and then these really quick changes of edits.
Yeah, quick
so
cutting.
Quick cutting. So you kind of felt like you, it was like really, you could feel like kind of the tacking of the cameras and how intense it is and the camera flashing and the lights and that kind of stuff. So I feel like there might have been some ways of kind of getting that up there. So it was very quick.
We have to watch that again.
Yeah.
It's almost like maybe he was doing it like how she felt about it. Like,
yeah,
how she perceived,
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
Like she was being attacked,
yeah,
by it.
I,
it was like too
I
much.
Watched that scene two times and I'm still like, and sort of quite how they got that, but it seems you can really feel that paparazzi energy of being attacked and her like this vulnerable person being just pushed around.
I bet your sound had a lot to do with it.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Well. I mean, I remember when I was watching it, you're right, having that feeling. I'd forgotten like how chased she was, you know.
Yeah.
How close, like she had nowhere to move really. She was like a prisoner really at that point.
Yeah.
But now, remember when we first saw it, we also talked about how entertaining and riveting it was, but kind of borderline on feeling like it's a tabloid.
Yeah.
Like
sure.
That her own like horrific kind of decline that was so intimate and private, especially because it's using all these like shot, like footage from her friends. And so
they
feel like you're kind of getting into, you're being entertained by this person's pain.
You know? So it's definitely very realistic. And you can see some very personal moments that I'm sure, you know, that she was trying to, you know, keep hidden. And I think there was a really interesting scene where I think it's her friend is doing a footage of her shooting her in rehab in an island, which I guess it was probably the nicest rehab you can get in. She's, I don't remember this part. I don't know if you, is the husband at that point, they get them to go to rehab, but they only would go to rehab together.
Blake.
But they only go to rehab together, and everybody's like, don't do that because that's like a really bad idea. Like two addicts. And then it was a scene where she's like, you know, where Blake's like, remember that song when I'm going to rehab?
Yeah.
And teasing her about that and saying, you know, you're to change that, like, go to rehab or not. And she's like, actually, I like it here. So you kind of have the sense of her wanting to stop in some regard. But her being like, I don't know, needled. It's a very personal moment, but this very kind of pointed moment of her, maybe a place where something could have happened if maybe they didn't go. Or, like, cause I think they talk about how the first time a lot of addicts won't stop doing drugs. The first going to rehab. It takes a couple of times going to rehab.
Yeah, and they said like
three or four times, but still, maybe. I think the documentary had left you in a moment feeling like maybe if he didn't go with her, maybe there was a moment. Because, I mean, if he doesn't want to do it, then that's going to be very hard on her to want to stop taking drugs.
Yeah.
Basically.
You know, it's true. As I was thinking about the film, it kind of oddly, and this is how it seems to happen to us every time we do a podcast.
Yeah.
Cherry brought up the Romeo and Juliet story.
Yes. Yeah.
And oddly
enough, a bit of that, isn't it?
This kind of has a bit of that, like, Romeo and Juliet story, and that this was kind of a relationship that was doomed from the start.
Yes, yeah.
And one of the people ends up dying. You know, I mean, Romeo and Juliet, they both die.
Yeah.
But it's almost like this doomed relationship story.
This young life, this young love, or the first love almost, going on.
It was her first love.
I think it was her first love. I think they were, like, really young when they started dating, when they first
She was 19, I think.
Yeah, she was.
Younger. Actually, no, she was even younger.
She was, because she started living by herself.
She was 17.
16. She was 17. I think it was a year after the scene. She started 16, so yeah, I think it was 17. So you're right, it was a little bit of that doomed love affair. And they kind of did talk about that, of them, like, this kind of being like twins. He talked about that in the interview.
Yeah, and they were like soulmates, but they were like he was toxic to her.
Yeah, because she wanted to be like, I think it was one of her friends said this, like, she wanted to have, or it was her saying that they wanted the same mental capabilities. So if she wasn't on a trip with him, then she didn't feel like she was with him.
Yeah.
It had to be the same, which I've heard is kind of like when you're, when somebody's in like a different mental space, like on drugs, they often are very difficult to be with.
Yeah.
Because they're not there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not in our frame of world.
Yeah.
Their brain's chemistry is changing even, I think, when you're on drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, and I just have to say, kudos to the editor.
I agree 100%. It's probably one of the hardest things.
I think it's probably
one
of the
hardest things.
Yeah. And he really, I mean, I'm sure Asim was a big part of that, but he really kind of made the speed, or she, I don't know what the gender of the editor is. But I'll look it up sometime. But I think that the editor did a really good job of really creating this story.
Well, thank you for selecting another excellent, thought-provoking film.
Yes.
If you have not yet seen Amy, now's your chance, and you can see it on Netflix.
I want to welcome all our listeners to see Glorious Call and all the other wonderful films in the program on June 29th at NFMLA's event spotlight LGBTQ+ Stories.
June 29th is just getting squeezed in on Pride Month.
It is. It's right at the end. For more information, go to newfilmmakersla.org/events.